The following presentation is brought to you by the Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll take you for a trip in the Wayback Machine to 1979 and an interview I did with proudly pornographic film director Russ Myers. He was on a barnstorming tour through the South when I met him in Gainesville, Florida. Stick around, but be warned, there will be sex talk ahead. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, brought to you today by Amazon.com. When you visit MrMedia.com and click on any of the links to purchase books, music, movies, gift certificates, or anything else through our Amazon link, you support this free video podcast. Whenever you need something else from Amazon, please consider returning to MrMedia.com to order it. It doesn't cost you any extra, and we sure appreciate the support. And don't forget, MrMedia.com has more than 1,200 celebrity audio and video interviews archived on the site. That's hundreds upon hundreds of hours free entertainment. Subscribe for free on MrMedia.com, and you'll instantly get an email every time a new interview is posted. You can also watch and subscribe to the show on YouTube, Vimeo, Dailymotion, The Realm Network, and Frequency.com. And if you preferred to just listen, Mr. Media is also available for free on iTunes, Spreaker, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Blueberry, TuneIn, Blog Talk Radio, Podfeed.net, and Player FM. You can subscribe to any of those services and never miss another episode. Finally, you can interact with Mr. Media Interviews on all kinds of social media, including Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and more. Friend or follow us, we'll friend or follow you back. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience full of Masters, Johnsons, and multiple other double entendres in the Nuna Media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Every time I think back to my legendary 1979 lunch with film director Russ Meyer at the Dutch Kitchen in Gainesville, Florida, I can't help but smile. He had stopped in at the movie theaters where I worked my way through college, the Royal Park Four Cinemas, and told our manager, Jim Simons, that he was hoping to generate some press for his latest film, Beneath the Valley of the Ultra Vixens, starring the pneumatically built Miss Kitten Natividad. Lucky me, Mr. Simons told him that I wrote for Gainesville Magazine and was also studying film at the University of Florida. We were introduced, and Meyer invited me and my pal and assistant manager, Alan Solomon, to the greatest business lunch of our lives. Over burgers, fries, and Cokes, at a restaurant, coincidentally, that Alan's father had literally opened for the chain years earlier, Meyer regaled us with behind-the-scenes tales of the life of a happy pornographer. And the more our young jaws dropped at his descriptions of cinematic sex, the more he enjoyed talking with us. I found the audio from this interview a few years ago and am presenting it publicly on Mr. Media for the first time. It is, admittedly, crude and lascivious at several points and not recommended for anyone easily offended or under the age of 18. If that describes you, please, please stop listening now. Thank you. Meyer, the director of everything from Jacqueline Suzanne's Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, which was written by film critic Roger Ebert, as well as The 7 Minutes and Up, to Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, Fanny Hill, and Pandora Peaks, lost his virginity in the Army thanks to a prostitute procured by, this is true, Ernest Hemingway. Now, Meyer told many of his secrets in a 3-volume memoir, A Clean Breast, The Life and Loves of Russ Meyer. He died on September 18th, 2004. And now, my interview with Russ Meyer, from sometime in 1979.
About why you wouldn't want to do a regular film when you become an executive.
I said that I did 2 so-called straight films in my career.
What were the name of the film?
One was The 7 Minutes, based on Irving Wallace's bestseller, supposed bestseller. Bestsellers should be 3,000 books today, you know. It was based upon, as I say, his book, and it dealt with an idea of censorship of books, busting and this prosecution and defense and its exoneration. Why it seemed to be a fair possibility is that dealt with the censorship theme. And I was conned into, I say conned into doing it in two ways, by David Brown, who was Richard Zanuck's partner when I was at Fox. It had such a smashing success with Beyond the Valley of Dolls, and I felt that I could really do anything. And instead of doing a film that I had intended to do, it was a violent film, it was written by Peter George, who did Dr. Strangelove, it was called Final Steel. I was deterred from that as the next project and went ahead with 7 minutes. One of the reasons they wanted it done is that they had spent over $1 million on scripts and pre-production, one with Richard Fleischer, and they finally decided not to do anything about it. I remember Fleischer talking with me. I never met him personally, but we were both on a lot at the same time, and he borrowed a print of Vixen to acquaint himself with the so-called pornography at the time. Anyway, the film came out, and there was really high hopes for it. In fact, I had to smuggle it off the lot. It's kind of curious because Zanuck was persona non grata on the lot. Now we find him back there again. The same regime that replaced him has now invited him and Brown back to Chicago. I mean, not Chicago, to 20th Century Fox. And anyway, I had to smuggle a print. Devious means, putting it in the trunk of my car and driving off and going down to his outrageous layout down on the beach in Santa Monica, and he had his own projection room. And we looked at the print, myself and an agent and an associate producer as well, and Zanuck and his old lady, Linda Harris, at the time, and we all felt very strongly that this was a great soap, so to speak, on that basis. And had high hopes for it. Well, I went out on a press junket, and my old lady and I, Edie Williams, along with our press representative, who would meet us in the Cincinnati Exchange territory, and we thought we'd open the picture right in the eye of the hurricane, as it were, Charles Keating Land, who headed the Citizens for Decent Literature. That had always given me a lot of trouble. Certainly, the prosecutions with the film Vixen was prosecuted in Florida as well. It was a kind of a brush fire thing out of Cincinnati. And the first night, the theater was just thronged. It was packed, absolutely packed. The second night, it was half full. Public, as one boy said to me in the audience, I said, "What did you think of the film?" He said, "I've always been a fan of yours," but he said, "You spent so much time in the courtroom and you spent the equivalent time on peaceful screening." He just said it exactly, that way. That's fine, thank you. And what happened is that, sure, it had some sex. We had simulated stag films that were being projected, for the crooked politician and a couple of so-called love scenes. But the leading lady, for example, give you an idea, some of the restrictions are placed upon you. I normally expect a girl just to lose her laundry and, jump around. I used Marianne McAndrew. She was the second lead in Hello, Dolly, a very beautiful brunette. And she had to do what she dreaded, but it was delineated. Curiously, her husband was a fan of my films. But she feared through the whole production this inevitable scene in which she had to be laying in front of a fireplace making love to Wayne Maunder, who was Maunder, M-A-U-N-D-E-R. McAndrew was MC, in front of the fireplace, making love to him, and discussing the day's happenings at the court, at the trial, which the book was exonerated, plus the seller. And she finally agreed to do it by having pasties cut out, flesh colored, that never attached the nipples of her breasts. And and it was not so much for, they didn't photograph her breasts, it was all close up and so on. It was the idea she didn't want anybody to see her nipples. Had we had photographed them, it would have been kind of ludicrous. They were well blended in, but it would have been a girl with no nipples. You know.
Sort of like airbrushed.
Yeah, in a sense, but they were applied by the makeup department, your body makeup. Well, that was the pattern all over. We went to Detroit. And we went to Milwaukee, went to three towns, and the same thing happened, and Fox just dropped the distribution. Bam. We had it in these three test markets. And, oh, there was one in New York, and it just died. Just died. The people stayed away. They were all so excited. Here was a sequel, like, to be on the Valley of Dog. Let them down. So, I was married to, at the time, Edie Williams, who was not at many moments of pleasure, but she wanted very much to star in every other film I would have made for the rest of my life. It really boiled out of that. And as an alternate, I thought, well, let's take another shot at it. And I'll make a film. In fact, it was written by a young man down in Miami. His name was Manny Diaz, and he was my production assistant at Fox, D-I-E-Z. He's Panamanian, and good writer, really, really good writer. Excellent. So he helped me on the ending of Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. He wrote some independent screenplays that we tried to get off the ground. One, in fact. And and he was my production assistant and contributed mightily to the 7-minute script. So he had written a screenplay on the white, it was called, we titled it Black Snake, meaning the whip. But it was based loosely on a book called The White Witch of Rose Hall. It's about one of the last plantations that was left in the Caribbean, lorded over by a very abundant, you know, profane, outrageously cruel lady who the evil joxer, what would you call him, the overseer, the dirty white linen suit and so on, had a great British cast, great actors. He was Dave Prowse, in fact, in it. So I first met him. He was Darth Vader in Star Wars. We've become great friends since then. And made great preparations, and my taste in women had not altered, and I boiled down to using an Italian actress, though, that had a British work permit. We used a British cast, and it was a British-oriented thing, and the whole works. Of course, shooting Barbados. Oh, well, we were down there doing pre-production, getting ready to go, and the picture was totally cast. I got a call from the agent in England saying that the lady I'd selected had overdosed on cocaine or something and was in a sanitarium. So I had to take my second choice, which was a girl with two backs.
Two backs?
It's an expression.
Oh.
No tits.
All right.
Okay. And a good actress. Her name is Anushka Hempel. A-N-O-S-C-H-K-A Hempel. She owns a hotel.
I can tell you've got a lot of these.
So she came over, and she was hostile throughout the whole film, not particularly cooperative, particularly when it came to some nudity, mild stuff, because we were intent on doing an R-rated picture. A picture of this nature should play in the mainstream at the time without any kind of hostility from advertising and reluctance on the part of certain theaters to play it. You know, again, the public reacted exactly the same way. Well-made film, Panavision, slick as hell. Good acting. No interest. Just died. Absolutely died. Blacks hated it. Whites hated it. Finally got bailed out in England. Played in England. and people looked upon it as a parody. It was a satire, and a lot of lesser nations bought it. The film was finally got its money back.
Well, in comparison to the number of people who went to see those movies in the space that it was released, with the problems that she explained that it had, comparing that to the number of people that go see the Vixens movies, or the following, is there that great a difference?
Good Christ, yes.
Cute.
Oh, it's cute. Enormous.
It is.
The Vixen, for example, is one of the top grocers, one of the top 200 grocers ever made. So is Super Vixens. So is Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. So is Cherry Henry Kell. I'm the only filmmaker that has four films in the top 200 grocers of all time. There is no question about it. It's just, you can't even begin to compare. It's a drop in the bucket that went and see that. Vixen has line 68, 69 around the block. You know?
Going on that, why is it that you could not put out a movie?
Well, but you see, now you're asking me a question that everybody asks. I have to tell you frankly, I am happy in my plight. I'm obsessed. Now, let me finish now. I'm obsessed with the bosom. I'm obsessed with sex. I like to fuck. I make a lot of money. And I'm like Jack the Giant Killer in many respects. I make a film and I'm in competition with the major. It's a great rugby match, so to speak. I have no interest or desire anymore to make a straight film. It would not hold my attention like getting a semi-hard on when I'm photographing Miss Tibby Dodd, bouncing up and down on somebody's bones. It's simple as that. I'm in a great position in life. I get great broads. I make money. I make slick films, slick as any major film. I have no desire to do anything else. See, there's something to be said for making the best Rushmore film that's made.
That's true.
That's it.
See that?
So, as far as seeking out why, I don't think I could be more emphatic. There are so many benefits from what I do.
That's good as far as I can expect.
Sincere, really.
No problem with that.
Sincere.
A little surprised at that, but all right. So let's.
But look at the track record. You know, look at the number of films that have been tits and ass pictures. You know.
How many Vixens movies are there? There was Vixen, Super Vixen, there was Ultra Vixen.
And now Ultra Vixen. Now next will be the Jaws of Vixen.
Oh, you are going to do that. The only reason I ask is in the review I was just reading. It was a Playboy review, and they said that that was for Ultra Vixen, and they said that the next one was going to be Jaws of Vixen.
Yeah.
I thought maybe that was a joke.
No, I put at the end of the film, I have a little plug. I always have like seven endings. You can leave at any time. Because it's hard to come down on a thing where a steeplechase fucking. Yeah. How do you come down? Well, in Super Vixens, we did it in a sense. Blew the heavy up with the dynamite, you know, Roadrunner style. So I moralize in a phony way about. That's a phony in an outrageous way about where all the people went wrong. I do it in this film. I do it visually myself. I'm the one on camera with someone dubbed my voice a la Bogart. But at the end of the film, we have the Walter Brennan man coming on and saying, be sure to watch for the further adventures of Livonia and her bosom buddies, you know, and so on. And then it says, Jaws of Vixen. And then he says, she'll never let go. And then you hear a big pop, which is the plumber's friend, you know. And, like, in other words, she'd been sucking a cock and her mouth slipped. And it gets laughed, you know. And it's, why not do that rather than say the end? The end never got anybody a laugh. You know, unless you were doing an ass-fucking movie. Throughout the end. So they laugh. It's one more laugh. And every time you can buy a laugh, which to me is more important than some guy salivating there getting his nuts off looking at some drawn with giant tits who's into it like I am. Yeah, it's much more satisfying to hear people laugh. For example, I have a good scene that reacts well. There was a guy taking a shit in a junkyard, you know, and a redneck slips up behind him with a shovel, shits in a shovel. But Anyway, that's for sure. And it's you mentioned the title, Brows of Vixen. People break up, yeah. So already you got a laugh.
Yeah. Right? No, that's for sure. No. I looked at it and I was just as a curiosity. Some muscle curious now. Now I'm studying film and I'm really curious, going to a movie like any of the Vixen movies, how much script is there really?
Oh,
how
it's
much
is totally scripted.
It is.
Totally. I have a tendency to detail the action out tremendously. For example, you might say the Vixen, how much, yeah, it was scripted, but like I'll have a paragraph when it says Vixen, you know, goes and whips open the shower curtain and she has an exchange of dialogue with her brother and they get in the shower and then I have a big paragraph in which she's caressing her and soaping her body and so on and so forth. The next thing we see him in bed. Then it's a big paragraph that says that Vixen wails away with brother Judd in an outrageous expression of animal sex, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I do that and I describe how she's doing it and her breathing and so on. And the actress looks at it and she sees a page of single space written sexual descriptions of how she's reacting, how she's debauched, depraved, needful, incestuous, and so on. And it helps the girl. Helps the girl very much to read a conception of what I think she should do. And if she's bright at all, you don't go all through that phony bullshit of director sitting down and directing people. It's so...
So she knows what you expect her to be doing.
She's, first of all, she's fucked a lot. And she's fucked a lot of guys. She knows the basic reason why she's in one of my films, aside from having a great body and an interesting face. She knows, and she's been fucking for several years. But now she sees an article on what my interpretation of this relationship is. First of all, it's incestuous. Secondly, she's absolutely spaced out because of some sort of minor triumph that's occurring in her own mind. She's finally seduced her brother, you know, who's been a thorn in her side. He would, you know, his constant aggravation about his black friend. So that's it. So the films are very carefully scripted. Carefully. The whole point that I make in my films is the story is secondary to the action. Always very definite, but it is a story. There is a story, but it's a story like Al Cap might do when he's doing one of his comic strips. It's a simple story, and it generally always revolves around a very aggressive woman, which I like, sexually aggressive, outrageous, abundant, pneumatic, the whole thing. Always with a guy who's a nice guy, klutzy, inexperienced, generally too with some big sex problem. So her job is to correct that problem for therapy. Not therapy necessarily for him, but in the case of Ultra Vixen, she seems like the most promiscuous lady in town. But she finally affects a confrontation. If you want to think that deeply about the story, fine. Say, well, and I can sit unexplained. See why she did this and this and this. It's all meant to be surface. Primary reason in that for you to go into that theater is to maybe wet your pants a little bit, get a semi, have your prurient appeal pruriently appealed to. And if you like big tits, you're going to be terribly satisfied and have all kinds of fantasies on your own. And if you're a middle-aged married couple and you see people doing the kangaroo pouch, you just might go home that night and try a new position.
Question. I was thinking about it. I once had a conversation with someone who was asking me, not asking me, we were just trying to come to some conclusion. If someone who wrote pornography or dirty stories, whichever, you know, might have heard to be heard, if they could actually get off on their own material, could you sit in a theater? Get off on a film that you did, you put it together?
No, I was too close. First of all, I'm too close to... the film, because that's bullshit. I devote myself for a great period of time in post-production, like this current film, Beneath. 9 months of editing, sound effects. 9 months. It's so slick this time. Every cut matches. Better than a major. Technically, it's just as good as Bottom of the Wind. You know, I make no bones about that, nor do I make any bones about there's no big involved story. Very simple story. The main idea is the flesh. The fucking frustrations, you know, hang-ups, that's it. And in the sum total, some film buffs look very deeply into the film and see all sorts of psychological factors, you know. And it's, any film I do is an extension of my own fantasy and very much inside of me, what makes me tick, what appeals to me. What you're seeing is something that turns me up. Answer your question, I can't very well, because I don't like to look at film that I've been living with so many times. I've seen, for example, when I finish a picture, I look at every print, first 25 prints. I look at it for lighting. Not lighting, but print quality. You know, when you print with a printing light. You can have maybe too magenta or too green or too blue and so on. So after a while, it becomes then just a very mechanical thing to look at. I don't think into it, but I get it off when I'm editing. I really get it off mentally when I'm editing and putting together a sequence with some broad fucking guy. I can really get it off there. And if I wanted to, I could whack it right there, right in front of the but instead I have Kitten there who will, I can be working there and she'll get down on the floor and suck on my joint while I'm editing. Really? She's there and, you know, bleeds me like a tire. So she got everything going for you, you know?
Right.
Complete pleasure.
Okay, now let me get some stuff I'd use in the games with son.
Well, but you can couch these things in all sorts of
things. I need some things like, you were married to Edie Williams. What's your status now? You unmarried? Do you have any children?
No. She was, had become pregnant and then had a miscarriage over a publicity story that my previous wife had come out with. I was editing 7 minutes. Interesting, it's a good question. You know, I don't think I've said all along is it helps me very much in my new film. Because the new film will really be digressing from a self-analysis of Russ Meyer. I'm going to be very honest, things that are good or bad. Things I'm proud of, things that I'm kind of ashamed of. Not kind of ashamed of, in my life. I want to narrate it. So as Ebert, who has been an associate of mine a long time, he says, I don't ask me to write this, he said. He says, this must be you. You must say what you feel in film, which I will. But anyway, it was over an article that my second wife, Eve, had published in the paper, and it freaked her out so that... she told me afterwards that she ran around this, we had an extensive estate, ran around just freaking out, and I was working Sunday as I'm wont to do, editing 7 minutes, and a Fox policeman came up and says, your wife taken to the emergency hospital, she's had a miscarriage. I don't mean to say it was self-induced, it was, I don't know what she did, she just, you know, and so she lost the child. But anyway, everything works out for the best. I think she would have been happy with the child. She had her eyes on a career, you know. But she dumped the morning sickness anyway. And I have a child out of wedlock, a boy, you know, with a lady that I've known for years, who's married and has three other children, and the boy doesn't know I'm his whole name, nor does her husband. They had a lax period of some 4 months in their life. And they have an open marriage. If they have somebody in their life, they do. And so we have a regular thing, she and I, to this day, like once every 3 months. All places we meet down near Disneyland, repair to a motel, and wail away at each other for 3 hours. That's why we've never had a problem, because we've never been together long enough to have a problem. It's a problem with too many marriages. People are together too much. Yeah.
I was thinking when you mentioned that the next one is going to be about more about you.
No, it's a retro of all my films.
Right.
See, I mean, I'm going.
I was picturing something very similar to what we're doing now.
Well,
I was going to come in on you, and you're going to start talking about something, and then all of a sudden we're going to go into a flashback, and we're going to see these scenes, and what I wish I had done, or what I did do, and why did I, you know.
Well, is that your conception?
That was the first thing that came to my head when you said.
Well, first of all, people ask me what is their favorite film, and I have no favorite film. There are sequences that are favorites of mine. So I want to deal with, to begin with, I'm going to Europe Sunday with two army buddies, or cameramen there with me in the service, and we're going to reconstruct the route march that I had. And I rented a particular kind of car, which I have a duplicate at home. And we're going to photograph like run-bys in specific towns. And I have some really good war footage, combat footage, 16 millimeter. And I'm going to do it would appear a serious kind of opening, a documentary. Where did it all begin? And I'll enter it. And intercut, though, I'll have a big girl we've got in Germany, Dolly Dollar, who looks like Dolly Parton, and she will be in various stages of undress, intercut with warfare in current Germany, women eating whipped cream and Volkswagen and so on, and one of my friends will have to fuck her in a trench every now and then. And we'll intercut that with people firing machine guns and tanks firing, and the conclusion will be that war and sex is pretty much the same. It's a contest. And I'll be driving along talking, and then I'll get into, now why did it happen? Why did this all happen? And I'll talk frankly, and write it very honestly, and we'll deal with the bosom and the ash, my addiction to violence, which is not current in a certain film. Junky violence, fucking in trees, and airplanes, and boats, in cars, adultery, statements about social satire, and then I'll get into a 45-minute vignette, which at the moment revolves around my parodying famous scenes in films, like, for example, Women in Love, remember that, with Oliver Reed wrestling with another guy in front of a fireplace nude? Classic picture, D.H. Lawrence.
I have an excuse, so I'm still with you.
All right, okay.
I'm
just telling you, they have two nude men, but it was done in a genteel way. I'll do it out in a cruel desert, and each man will have a huge dick, you know, and just throwing each other, and we'll have a woman maybe in a cage pacing back and forth. It's just so hot, but the winner gets her, you know? And things like that, parody. Maybe a parody on Gone with the Wind. But that... in fact, came out last night about, I don't give a damn, guy, maybe a couple of black people doing it. I don't give a motherfucker. You know, that kind of stuff. See? And then a fast ending with, along that line. I think it'll work on two levels. I think it'll work on a documentary kind of art level, and it'll also work on a sex exploitation. I tried it at SC. I had a fellowship that was granted to me about 4 months ago. So I took clips from the many films. I thought I was somebody lifting some music from Vixen, that how pathetic. What was I saying now?
You had a fellowship from SC.
Oh yeah, and I showed clips from all my films. Whereas in the past, particularly in the picture Called Up that preceded this, I had a very, what I thought was a very jokey horror film, a scene with violence, with buzz, chainsaw and double-bitted axes, and Smokey the Cop's yelling out Sidney Carlton's line to the far, far better thing I do as he charged the towering giant who was about to throw the buxom Raven Delacroix down to the rapids below. And he charged him with a buzz of the chainsaw to the accompaniment of the 7th Cavalry bugle charge. And blood was just saw in the giant's chest, and he used 12 watermelons and 12 matching shirts. Red pulp comes out and the whole works. And overdone, just so overdone. Oh, I got a lot of letters from women saying, oh, you ruined it for us. But footage to the university. Had about 4,000 students in the time. They roared at the violence because it was out of context. There was none of the impending doom kind of build-up. The guy wrenching the saw off the wall. Uh-oh, here it comes. Eh? Instead, first thing you saw was a guy going, charging the giant in the blood, and everybody roared and laughed because they, where it really worked was without the build-up. Pending, their own impending doom, just outrageous spoofery having to do with violence. So, feeling, based upon that, that the college students to begin with will enjoy the film. That's the jaws of action.
What was the gist of the fellowship? What was behind that?
Well, I've had a lot of film festivals at universities, Ivy League, Northwestern, University of Illinois, Georgia State, so on, over the last 15 years. And distribution of my films in colleges through the 16 millimeter format has been most successful. And I encountered this Dr. Ungerite, who was at, through one of the girls that interviewed me at a radio station. He was a professor of cinema at Florida State. And addressed the group yesterday. It was a nice, you know, kind of off-the-wall discussion. There are so many people that are aware of what I've done. And the reaction so far, I'm confident that it could be my most successful film. It could be. You get something works on more than one level, you know. Appeal to the one-arm readers and Raincoat Brigade, but you can also appeal to the sophisticated college audience. The basis of this thing was then to, of course, first of all, set up by one of the fraternities. Now it became a fellowship and then an associate professor kind of standing there at SC to lecture whenever I could. So I've just signed too with, New Line Cinema. Is it New Line?
Yeah.
To represent me on a lecture basis. They really pay a tremendous amount of money for this kind of lecturing stuff, you know. I'm not ready to do it, but every now and then there's a chance I will do it. And having traveled around so extensively with Ultravox, it's prepared me in many ways to be able to never prepare any kind of speech. Just right off the wall. You know, the way I look at some guy and I see that, you know, he may be into tits and I can talk, you know, and get it off. It's like a great broad getting you off.
Yeah, Ferner is terrific. You mentioned when we first started talking about that you had some problems in Florida with a suit or something.
This picture was busted in, it's called Five Points, I think it was near Jacksonville. It seemed to me there was a town called Pinellas Park. Yeah, I think it's in that area. It was a direct result of the activities of the Citizens for Decent Literature in Cincinnati. Film, there's a tough area for showing anything that deals with sex, whether simulated or hardcore. And I went down there and after a year, even I was ill-advised to open, but we did open after the film had been in reach for a year, and they busted it. And we fought in every court within the state, lost at every level. The prosecutor, in fact, was the son of the presiding judge. And out of that developed little brush fires elsewhere that we had to combat. They were intent upon putting me in the slammer, but I had so much money from Vixen. Every week, $60,000 would come in. I mean, literally, you know, just a tremendous amount of money.
See, my tuition flashing with them.
And it was possible. And I spent $250,000 in the state of Ohio and the state of Florida. So recently, Vixen, along with Super Vixens and Sherry, were re-rated to R with some cutting. So I will never do it again.
What year was this?
Well, it was in 75. That was when I was at Fox. It was hair-raising.
This was pre-Deep Throat.
Oh, yeah. Oh, way beyond. Vixen was the Deep Throat of its day. Way way before it.
What are the problems? Let's say, I don't know if this relates to it at all, if you have any interest involved, but Larry Flint is having with since it's, he's trying to ban the magazine, he's got criminal prosecution up against him in some states.
There's no relevance there. At the time, I was going through very much the same thing that Flint was going through. What had happened is the Supreme Court, that was the time of the Marwa decision about community standards and so forth, and they were not ready or willing to come up with a definitive decision with regards to what was indeed pornography. They haven't still to this day, you know. And so when we made our final appeal to the Supreme Court, they threw it back. The court threw it back and said that it's up to the state to determine because of our adjudication thing. So, Indiana, Ohio rather, had no state obscenity law, so they couldn't prosecute any further. So the thing died a quiet kind of death. It's still not available for playing in Ohio. It cannot play. And recently, as I said to you, we had it re-rated to an R, and I had an attorney approach the prosecutor who was still in power there. And he said, in essence, and this is hearsay, I repeat, this is hearsay because it was told to me by my attorney. I was not present. That's got to be clearly stated. That if the picture fiction was a G, he would bust it. So there are people with very long memories and probably very short dicks.
Are there leaving out your own at this moment, pornographic movies you would consider to be classic? Well, not are there, but which?
That I like personally.
You like personally?
Yeah. I like the work of Radley Metzger, who made pictures like Iowa Woman, Camille 2000, the Licorice Quartet. He made elegant films that were similar to mine in the sense that he always dealt with almost near European aristocracy. The idle rich, luxurious, fucking, you know, caressing, and a lot of foreplay. Mine is a football scrimmage, the wildebeest and the water buffalo.
Did you see the movie The Innocent?
Yeah.
That sounds like...
That's more that kind of thing. But his was a lot more graphic than The Innocent. And Therese and Isabel was sort of a lesbian encounter, girl. And I admired his work. I haven't really seen anything else that's done anything for me. Because I don't look at a film by breaking it down and trying I go to film to be entertained. That's why I like Peck and Paw or Don Siegel or Clint Eastwood.
What about more general, more recent films? You know, things like the Lucas films, the Spielberg films.
I was very moved by Close Encounters. I don't care for Apocalypse. I say it's a great film, but I don't care for it as entertainment. I just don't care for it as entertainment. I admire it as being a great film, but as far as entertainment is concerned, negative. For me. Other things, Star Wars, great movie, you know? THX 11 something, bullshit. Not entertaining, you know? Don't stop and break it down and say, well, all the effects are great, or the lap dissolves are wonderful, and so on. That's why I like Siegel in his films. I look forward to every film that he makes. Martin Ritt I like. Except when he gets into big social things like Norma Rae. Great film, but didn't entertain me, you know? I think Great White Hope had some nice moments, but he still got into social commentary. I like The Spy That Came In From the Cold, which I think is the best film that Burton ever made. Ritt produced that, directed it. And Peckinpah, great bloodline, hello, bias, great, head-knocking, arm-rending.
This is totally, has nothing to do with anything I want from the image of a human. Did you see a Clint Eastwood movie called The Gauntlet? It was one of his more recent...
The bus.
Right.
Yeah, running the gauntlet.
It seemed like right up your alley from what you...
Yeah, that was a good... I like that.
All that shooting at the bus and shooting. They never hit the tires. They just kept shooting the bus.
Yeah, well, that's been one of the greatest... They had steel wall tires.
That had nothing to do with it.
Yeah. Well, I love the title, The Gauntlet, because it's a derivative of... the Mohicans or the Iroquois Indians would take the white settlers, and if they survived the gauntlet, then they let them go. The gauntlet was two rows of Indians with clubs, and the guy had to run between them as they took shots at him. And if he were done in by the time, then they'd, I don't know, castrate him or draw and quarter the guy or whatever. But if he survived that run through from his head knocking, then he was really A-okay. Well, poor Indian, they always talk about. They're pretty fiendish bastards, you know. And don't give me any films that have social commentary or Ban the Bomb or Three Rivers or Jane Fonda's horse shit. Her ugly husband, you know, that whole thing. I just want to be entertained.
Are there any current, the bigger box office stars, are there people that you'd like to work with?
No.
Just
my ladies.
Even let's say if they're big fans of Russ Meyer's films.
It's not in the realm of possibility, because to be in a film of mine. So on one end of the ledger, I'm respected in the Los Angeles community as being a maverick and a very skilled filmmaker who goes against the grain and has the crassness to go out and say, I'm going to compete with Streisand and Newman, and I'm going to play right next door to their film, and I do. Then there's this other saying, oh, just such terribly big, awful-breasted women, you know. Jesus, my ideal casting, it would never occur. It would be Dolly Parton and Jonathan Winters. That would be the ideal casting in the West Wing.
That would be funny.
Yeah, just sensational. So it's not about to happen. And it's, from a practical sense, to get big names would produce a film with such an outrageous budget. It's not just simply paying someone $1 million. You have to buy the trailers and the accoutrements and the people that accompany them and the kiss asses that have to be paid and the hairdressers. It's not practical. Now, you mustn't think in terms of my doing something bigger or better. No, I say you. It's my pub. Mustn't think in terms of me being more sensitive, doing something bigger or better, or dealing with major stars. The simple fact remains, the greatest excitement that I experience is going out myself with my can of film and being a kind of a modern Barnum and Bailey, P.T. Barnum, getting out there and extolling the virtues and the qualities of my pictures and actually inducing people to come and see them in great numbers. Satisfaction at a time when the whole industry is geared to so much departmentalization. Specialists in distribution, specialists in publicity, specialists in ass-kissing. All of that. Incredible resources. Publicity from day one when they start production. Publicity during the course of post-production. Massive publicity was released. I quietly start a film, work on it, get it finished. Then I carefully ascertain how much I want to spend. I realize that if I come into Gainesville, I'll make just as much money spending $600 as $1,200. And for pound and buck spent, I probably make a lot more than any major production. A ratio basis.
How much packing do you need to do?
Very little.
Well, I mean, I don't know how close you are, but we've got to...
I've told him all. He's come up with some interesting questions. Here is a brochure.
I'll see you back to the
room. Oh, media.
What? I'm going back.
We're going to go back to the room. What time do we leave?
We ought to leave here in about, 45 minutes.
45? Okay, yeah, I have to do some things, make a call or two.
Okay.
We'll wind this up here if you are satisfied.
One last question. Why did you come to Gainesville?
Have you ever heard of Ukiah, California?
Yeah,
population of...
Damned if I remember why, but I have.
All right, it has a population of about 16,000. Your population here must be at least in excess of 50,000.
Yeah, it's close to 80.
That explains it. I go everywhere. Everywhere that I can get someone to talk to. And because I went to Ukiah, he did more business that week than any picture they had played in the last 3 months. That's why I'm here. I'm here to generate more business, more ashes on the seats, more acceptance of what I do. I can figure that I will automatically at least have another $1,000 added to the gross by my just coming into town. Dollars and cents. You want that?
Yeah.
That's a picture and so on.
Put that right up there with the...
Right. Yeah, well, you think you might have a whack at this newspaper here?
Yeah, I do. Hopefully. Something else too, because a lot of material wouldn't go in the daily paper.
Oh, of course, yeah. Yeah. But the paper would be, that's the primary reason for my meeting.
A believer, a bad idea to believe her.